DeRussy's Lane used to lie at the western edge of New Brunswick, New Jersey. It was a little dirt road running off Eastern Avenue, skirting an empty farm. It was almost on the borders of Somerset and Middlesex counties, and it was sufficiently rural, dark, and underused to be a popular lover's lane for courting couples, especially those old enough to be mollicking in cars or holding conversations about Uganda with their neighbours' wives or husbands or fiancés. Thursday, the 14th of September, 1922, was an evening of extraordinary activity in the peaceful, romantic locale. At 4:30 that day, Mrs. Eleanor Mills, wife of the sexton of St. John the Evangelist's church, cut an article on divorce by an advanced Episcopalian vicar out of the New York World. Mrs. Mills was a lead singer in the church choir and a prominent parishioner. She told her 16-year-old daughter, Charlotte, that she was going to drop the article on the desk of Dr. Edward Hall, the rector of St. John's. At 6:15, Jimmy Mills, the sexton, came home from the church, where he'd been sweeping up builders' shavings in the vestibule. His marriage was fairly tense, and Mrs. Mills snapped at him that he was late. At 7:00, while Mr. Mills was working on his back stoop, nailing together some window boxes, Mrs. Mills popped out to make a telephone call from the nearby candy store. At 7:30, she came back home and put on her hat, shawl, and scarf. Jimmy Mills asked where she was going, to get the unfriendly response, "Follow me and find out." Meanwhile, in the large red-brick mansion close to the church where the Halls lived, Mrs. Mills's call had been taken by the rector. It was the second time she had called his residence that day, the first time he had been out. She'd left a message that there was a problem with her hospital bills, and she wanted to talk to Dr. Hall about it. And Dr. Hall, a handsome and popular priest, 7 years younger than his rich wife, told Mrs. Hall he was going out to see Mrs. Mills and sort out the problem of the hospital bills. At 8:00, motorman Thomas Meany saw Mrs. Mills get on his tram, which ran down Eastern Avenue almost to DeRussy's Lane. Mrs. Mills was the last passenger on the tram, and she got off and made her way in the direction of the lane. On the way, she met Mrs. Agnes Blust, whom she knew, and said a cheery good evening to her. Mrs. Blust noticed that she was carrying a parcel in her arm. Mrs. Blust walked on into New Brunswick proper, and as she passed Eastern Avenue School, she encountered Dr. Hall, also walking briskly in the same direction as Mrs. Mills, and only stopping to check his gold Hunter watch and compare its time with the school clock. At 9:30, a 23-year-old roustabout called Raymond Schneider brought his 15-year-old wayward girlfriend, Pearl Barmer, home to her father's bar. Nick Barmer was waiting for her. He was drunk, and he ordered her to go with him as he went for a walk to work off the alcohol in the pleasant autumn evening. Schneider followed the two at a little distance, muttering offensively about Barmer's drunkenness. As he pursued father and daughter, he was joined by two other lads, Clifford Hayes and Leon Kaufman. Not far from Dr. Hall's house, Schneider took his coat off and threatened to beat up Nick Barmer. Hayes took a pistol from under his sweater and said, "Don't mind, we're protected with this." But the drunken barkeep was not intimidated. He turned round and snarled, "What are you doing here?" And Hayes made an excuse and backed off. Nick and Pearl Barmer swung into Buccleuch Park, where the boys lost them in the twilight. But Hayes and Schneider headed toward a gully that led in the direction of DeRussy's Lane as Kaufman left them. A little before 10:00, millwright Robert Erling, who had been in and around the Lover's Lane with Jenny Lemford for 1.5 hours, returned from a pleasant sojourn in the undergrowth to his car. As they sat in it, they saw a local farmer riding up the lane on a mule. Now, this farmer was Miss or Mrs. Jane Gibson or Easton, a personage more usually described as the pig woman, because she kept a handful of porkers around the converted barn at the bottom of the lane where she lived with her half-witted son William. Most people believed that she was married to an Arthur Easton. She denied it. She would not say who she was or had been married to. She insisted that the Miss J. Gibson, often associated with her property, was her unmarried sister Jean. She was quite a raucous and memorable character, and her excursions up and down the lane that night on her mule, Jenny, were to prove important. Miss or Mrs. Gibson had been disturbed at 8:45 by her dog barking, so she came out of the barn and sat on a swing, watching and listening. Immigrants, as the extremely racist inhabitants of New Jersey termed anybody Jewish, Central European, Mediterranean, or Catholic, had recently settled on some of the adjoining farmland, and Miss Gibson believed they were stealing her crops. When a very rackly old wagon came up the lane between two fields of the pig woman's corn, Miss Gibson saddled up Jenny the mule and galloped off to this possible primordial predator as far as Eastern Avenue. As the old wagon rattled away to the right along the avenue, a car turned into DeRussy's lane, and according to her later statement, Miss Gibson observed that its headlights picked up two pedestrians standing beside the road, a white woman and what she took to be a black man. Later, she realized that the white woman was Mrs. Hall, and the black man was her brother Willie, who was in fact white, though his bushy hair and sallow complexion gave him a mulatto look. Miss Gibson then went back down DeRussy's lane, but suspecting that the escaped rattling wagon might yet make its way back across country to her corn, she rode Jenny along a little path in the direction of the empty Phillips farm and tied the mule to a cedar tree before starting to make her way back on foot toward the lane. As she approached a small crabapple orchard, she heard voices. She would claim that a woman shouted, "Explain these letters!" And then there were sounds of fighting, that a voice said, "God damn it, let go!" And in a momentary flash from an electric torch, she saw two men struggling, one of whom she would later claim was Mrs. Hall's other brother, Henry Stevens. Then in the darkness a shot rang out. A woman screamed repeatedly, and another, according to the pig woman, said in a very relaxed voice, "Oh, Henry." Then there were three more shots in quick succession, and the pig woman ran to her mule and skedaddled back to the safety of her converted barn, losing a moccasin on the way. Married church vestryman Ralph Gorsline had driven into DeRussy's lane just before all this excitement. He didn't especially want to be disturbed, as he had taken as his companion a pretty young lady from the church choir called Miss Catherine Rastall. So he was not pleased to hear a shot from the direction of the Phillips farm, followed by a woman screaming, followed again by three quick shots, after which the screaming slowly died out amid a murmur of voices. He put the time at 10:20. A couple of hours later, Miss Gibson ventured out again to look for her lost moccasin. The moon had risen by now, and as she approached the cedar tree where she had previously tethered Jenny, she saw a tall, white-haired woman kneeling close to one of the crabapple trees, apparently crying. The pig woman never found her moccasin, but she made a note of her eventful evening on her calendar. While all this was going on, Mrs. Hall was playing patience, quietly, in the parlour of the rector's mansion. Soon after 10, she summoned one of the maids to close up the house and shortly afterwards went to bed. At 2 a.m. she awoke and realized the rector was not in bed. She went downstairs to see if he was working, but there was no sign that he'd come home at all. So she went up to the bedroom where her eccentric brother Willie slept, and indeed where he spent much of the daytime with the door closed, since no one in the house could stand his smelly briar pipe. She told Willie the rector had not come home for the night, and her brother quickly dressed and joined her to go and see whether he was working at his study in the church. St. John the Evangelist was dark and closed. Remembering that phone call about Mrs. Mills's hospital bill, Mrs. Hall wondered whether the lead singer's illness had flared up, so she and Willie went over to the Mills's apartment building. All was dark, and Mrs. Hall and Willie Stevens went home again without ringing the bell. But Mr. Mills, too, had been puzzled by an absent spouse. The Millses had slept in a separate bedroom for some time, Mrs. Mills sharing a room with her daughter Charlotte. Charlotte had come in late and sunk into the deep sleep of the active adolescent. At about 3 a.m. she was roused by her father tapping on the door and asking whether her mother had come home. Charlotte grunted no and went back to sleep. Next morning, Mr. Mills went over to the church. partly to see whether his wife had gone there, partly to get on with normal janitorial duties. On the rector's desk, in the study by the vestry, he noticed the cutting-on divorce that his wife had extracted from his evening paper the night before. Mrs. Hall had passed a sleepless night, and without giving her name, telephoned the police to ask if there had been any casualties during the night. She was told there had not. She was quite satisfied that her husband was so well known that he would have been recognised and named at once if any hospital had admitted him. After this, she too went over to the church, where she learned from Jimmy Mills that Mrs. Mills had disappeared as well as the rector. "Do you think they've eloped?" Jimmy asked. He had reason to do so. For months his wife had been telling him that she cared more for the rector's little finger than for his whole body, and that as soon as Charlotte was through high school she intended to run away with Dr. Hall to Japan. But Mrs. Hall was too much the lady to acknowledge having heard anything about this, and dismissed the notion of an elopement. During the day, Mrs. Hall's sisters-in-law came to her support, but nobody reported the rector's disappearance to the police until the afternoon, when Mrs. Hall's lawyer advised her to do so. Mr. Hall and Mrs. Mills did not come home that night either. On Saturday morning, Ray Schneider had another date with Pearl Barmer. It was a sunny day, and they strolled along DeRussy's Lane. When they came to the footpath leading toward the old Phillips farm and the crabapple orchard, Ray suggested they wander down it. Pearl was in the lead, and it was she who noticed two people lying under a crabapple tree. When she got close, she noticed that they weren't breathing. Ray looked thoughtfully at the man and the woman lying on their backs beside each other and said, "Let's get out of here." The two frightened youngsters reported their discovery to the police, and Dr. Hall and Mrs. Mills had been found. They were fully clothed. The rector's Panama hat was pulled over his face. Mrs. Mills's hat had rolled away to her side. A scarf barely concealed the fact that her throat had been cut from ear to ear. There was also a bullet hole in her head. There were three in the rector's. Police found a spent 3-2 cartridge below the crabapple tree. The rector's wallet lay between the bodies. It contained his driving license and some identification papers. There was no sign of $50 or so which he'd taken out of the house with him. His gold watch and chain were also missing. His card case lay at a little distance. It contained visiting cards, Masonic and YMCA membership cards. Propped up neatly against his left heel was one of his own visiting cards, Edward M. Hall. Between and over the bodies lay a mass of sheets of paper. When gathered up and examined, they proved to be intensely passionate love letters in a schoolgirl hand. They were not immediately identified as Mrs. Mills's work, but that's what they were. And they were addressed to the rector, written in terms that left no doubt Mrs. Mills knew her passion to be reciprocated. Mrs. Hall's continuing protestations that she had absolute trust in her late husband's fidelity, and she was sure it would all be explained somehow, were ladylike, but unconvincing. On the crabapple tree, someone had carved a cross. And that's it. That's the evidence. That's all you've got to go on for a murder unsolved to this day. It made headlines because of the bungling efforts of the authorities. The case was difficult because it seemed to involve the two counties of Middlesex and Somerset, so two prosecutors competed with each other to solve the case. Ray Schneider and Leon Kaufman were questioned at enormous length, and eventually Schneider cracked. After 30 hours of interrogation, he confessed that he and Cliff Hayes had gone to DeRussy's Lane, where they'd seen the couple under the crabapple tree, and Cliff had shot them with his pistol. Hayes vociferously denied this, asking loudly whether he'd be such a mug as to stay around New Brunswick if he had committed a murder. The city agreed with him, and a special flag day was organized for his benefit. After Schneider had been fiercely interrogated again, this time being left in darkness for some time, he withdrew his accusation. Hayes was released, and Schneider was charged with perjury. For good measure, he was charged with statutory rape, since Pearl Barmer was under 16. And since Pearl announced that her father had been sleeping with her and this was the cause of the hostility between him and Ray, Nick Barmer was charged with incest, and Pearl made a well-deserved return to a home for wayward girls. The state authorities took over from the counties. They obviously saw the pig woman's story as more important than anything else. Mrs. Hall and Henry and Willie Stevens were in the frame. And Willie's insistence on behaving more like a publicity-loving small-town character than an anxious possible defendant made him interesting copy for the newspaper men who thronged New Brunswick. The pig woman herself was a larger-than-life figure, capable of threatening newsmen with a shotgun and adding details to her story every time she told it. Henry Stevens was an extremely dignified stockbroker who maintained implacably that he had been fishing at his cottage in La Follette the whole evening of the murders, and this could be proved by at least 10 local citizens who had seen him there. It was. Nonetheless, the case against Mrs. Hall and her brothers was put to a grand jury, which promptly threw it out. The pig woman managed to be vociferously half-hearted. If any woman stole her man, she'd chase her to the end of the earth and kill her. But still, murder had been done, and Mrs. Hall ought to pay the price. And there it rested, for 4 years, until William Randolph Hearst's gutter journal, The New York Mirror, revived it, demanding that Mrs. Hall and the Stevens brothers be put on trial. New evidence was produced. Ralph Gorsline had at last admitted to his adulterous tryst, thus confirming that the pig woman's almost incredible mule ride had not only taken place, but the shots she had heard had been fired as she said. A gung-ho prosecutor brought the charges, and the pig woman made her last dramatic appearance. She testified from a stretcher, while her mother sat at the front of the court, muttering that Miss Gibson was a downright liar and always had been. The jury agreed. And indeed, the pig woman's note on her calendar, which the prosecution discreetly suppressed, proved it. She had only heard the shots, she wrote, and she believed them, at that time, to be a farmer shooting at something. All the rest of her story, and the introduction of Mrs. Hall and Willie Mills, was introduced later. The jury discharged the unfortunate three. So who did it? Almost certainly, either a Peeping Tom thief, who made off with Mr. Hall's money and watch, or a band of Ku Klux Klan-associated vigilantes. Such people were quite active in New Jersey at the time, and in addition to their infamous racism, they objected to the Orthodox, Catholic, and Episcopalian churches, which roundly condemned their terrorism. And like IRA thugs, the Ku Klux Klan believed that it was virtuous to maim and occasionally kill people they deemed immoral. The fullest study of the case, by William Kunstler, concludes that it must have been a KKK action. A sensational and evil demonstration of the outrageous fundamentalist proposition that adultery really is worse than murder.